Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It was a fine summer day for the opening of the G8 summit today, 75 degrees and sunny. But even before the first meetings were held, climate change cast a dark shadow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 8th of July. Great to have you here. The G8 meeting opened today in L'Aquila, Italy. Leaders of the world's largest industrialized economies have a full schedule of events to keep them busy. A checkup on their promises of last year to work together to fix the global economy. New food aid programs, as we'll hear a little bit later on. And the small matter of climate change. President Obama set the stage before he left home. He promised to make global warming one of the key topics of conversation, and hopes have been rising that some of the world's biggest economies would sign up for drastic cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. But those hopes have apparently been adjusted, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Many campaigners had been expecting an historic accord tomorrow. They believe that the US, Europe, Japan, and the fast-growing economies like China and India were all going to agree to deep cuts in their carbon emissions, an overall 50% reduction by the middle of this century, with the rich countries cutting by 80%. But it seems those numbers will be missing from tomorrow's communique. Mark Nichols is editor of Environmental Finance magazine. He says the big emerging economies have balked.
I think there's skepticism amongst the Chinese and the Indians that the West will deliver on nearer term emissions targets and will provide financing again in the near term to developing countries to help them adapt to the effects of climate change.
He says the developing world harbours a deep resentment towards the rich countries over this issue.
The West has enjoyed industrialisation based on fossil fuels. China and India don't see why they should be denied that growth.
Instead of the numerical targets, tomorrow's communique is likely to contain an acknowledgement that global warming must not exceed a further 2 degrees centigrade. Not quite the commitment the campaigners were hoping for. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Global warming being global and all, what happened today at the G8 will inevitably become part of the political debate over climate change back here. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner is with us from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk to explain how that's going to happen. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Kai.
The president went to this summit with a climate change bill passed by the House in hand. What does this do for the political prospects back here?
Well, it's not very helpful, obviously. As you said, the House passed this bill, but it passed it by a very narrow margin. It's going to be even tougher to pass it in the Senate, and some folks believe it will be weaker as a result. Critics of climate change legislation in Congress will no doubt point to today's G8 failure, if you want to call it that, and say, see these developing countries, China and India, they're not willing to sign on the bottom line. Why should we commit to reductions in greenhouse gases? China and India, on the other hand, see the rather weak short-term goals in the U.S. legislation as a signal that America isn't very serious about achieving these greenhouse gas reduction targets, and they're not happy about it.
Yeah, the Democrats, though, have 60 votes in the Senate. They do have majorities in the House. Does this really weaken the prospects of that legislation?
Well, we really don't know. Phil Radford, who's head of Greenpeace USA, told me today he thinks the chances now are about 50-50 that we'll get a bill by the end of the year. Others are more optimistic. The problem is a lot of people say it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. You've got China and India on the one hand who want to see more serious commitments by the U.S. in greenhouse gas reductions in the near term. And they want more aid from the U.S. in achieving their own reductions. But the U.S. really can't or isn't willing to say what it can do before they see what the Senate will pass. So really, it's all just very bad timing.
Right. You go first. No, you go first. Right?
That's right.
Pan this forward for me for a little bit to the big climate change conference in Copenhagen. Copenhagen in December. There's this conference, the G8, our domestic political situation, and then Copenhagen in December.
Yes, the United Nations Climate Change Conference is a huge opportunity, of course, for the world to make serious commitments to greenhouse gas reductions. Climatologists would say it's the last chance. And many think this G8 meeting in Italy this week is crucial to Copenhagen's success. Now, having said that, there are other people who say, wait, don't panic. We have time. Things can change. This is sort of a pre-negotiation to that meeting. Why would all sides be putting their cards on the table right now? Here's William Klein at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
I don't think the G8 was expected to be the location for a massive deal on climate, so I don't see this as devastating.
And as Stephen Beard noted, Kai, negotiators at that G8 meeting are working on alternative language that would enforce a limit on global warming to no more than 2 degrees Celsius. But one French climatologist said today that's ecological suicide to pass language about reducing global temperatures without saying how you're going to do it. He says that's just empty rhetoric.
Sarah, thanks a lot. Sarah Gardner from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you picked up a major newspaper today, you may have come across a big advertisement from J.P. Morgan Chase. The bank had its message plastered on the pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, to name but a few. The ad is billed as the 11th in a series of messages from Chase called The Way Forward. Today's explains what the bank has been doing to modify mortgages and keep people in their homes, which could be quite a few people, since J.P. Morgan services almost a quarter of this country's 45 million mortgages. We asked Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson, though, why all the publicity?
You'd think the best way to reach homeowners in trouble would be to send them a letter or call them up. What if they don't read the New York Times? Well, J.P. Morgan spokesman Tom Kelly says the ad has a wider audience in mind.
We think it's important to make sure that people know that we're doing what we can to help the economy.
Which people exactly? Maybe the ones in the big white buildings in Washington, says Sanford Bernstein analyst Brad Hintz.
At a time where Congress is determining the regulatory rules, how financial institutions are going to be controlled, it's probably a prudent thing to position your firm as the man in the white hat who's trying to keep middle Americans in their homes.
In the ad, J.P. Morgan claims to have prevented 565,000 foreclosures since 2007. That includes people who were able to stick with the lower rate on their adjustable rate mortgages. Holden Lewis of Bankrate.com says the number sounds plausible, but like all ads, he says, J.P. Morgan's only tells part of the story.
I get a lot of emails from readers who are frustrated because they can't get any help from their mortgage servicer. And I would say of the major servicers, Chase is the one I've had the most complaints about.
But you won't hear many complaints about J.P. Morgan Chase at the Treasury Department. It was one of the first to pay back its TARP money. Still, like all big banks, it's got some work to do softening its image with consumers. And on that front, a full-page ad or 10 can't hurt. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, traders made the best out of what could have been a bad day. Oil dropped another $2 as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Potential buyers of the Boston Globe have a bit more time to think things over. The New York Times company that owns the Globe is said to have postponed today's deadline for initial bids. But the Globe isn't the only struggling paper in Boston. This week's issue of the Bay State Banner could be the last. The Banner, an African-American newspaper, started during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And Marketplace's Amy Scott reports this recession has hurt a number of minority-owned and ethnic newspapers around the country.
Melvin Miller borrowed $10,000 to start the Bay State Banner in 1965. Today, he says he can't get a line of credit to keep the paper running. As advertising revenue has fallen, Miller says he's kept the paper afloat with his own money.
And so the issue that remained to me is whether I was going to continue to underwrite the losses that we would suffer because of the decline in advertising. And the answer I came up with was no.
The banner's demise leaves Boston without a newspaper focused on African Americans. It's a story playing out around the country. Another black paper, the San Francisco Bay View, switched from a weekly print edition to monthly last year. A few papers aimed at Latino and Asian immigrants have shut down. But while some publications are closing and cutting staff, others are starting up. Edwin Okongo is with New America Media, a coalition of ethnic media outlets. He says these outlets cater to people who don't see themselves in the mainstream press.
This is what is really driving ethnic media. We want to read about ourselves.
Some are even making money. John B. Smith Sr. publishes the Atlanta Inquirer. He says his ad revenue is up this year. Smith says black newspapers are trusted by their readers, and advertisers like that.
They can get more for their dollar by using our newspapers all across the country.
Smith says minority-owned newspapers are used to struggling, so they're in a better position to survive these latest tough times. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Along with global warming and a worldwide recession, leaders at the G8 summit this week are going to talk about agriculture, specifically aid for farmers in poor countries to help them grow more food. In a new book called Enough, Wall Street Journal reporter Roger Thoreau says there is more that needs to be done to solve world hunger than just growing more food. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think probably most of us would guess that hunger and famine in this world are natural phenomena, that they're the results of droughts and poor planting seasons. You and your co-author, though, make a different case entirely, that it's all bad politics, really, and broken markets.
Yeah, that so much of today's hunger is caused by bad policy that spans the political spectrum, and policies that may have started off with good intentions, say our farm subsidies, food aid, ethanol incentives.
It sort of sounds as if you're saying for all the good that the West and specifically the United States tries to do in the area of food aid, getting food over there, giving hundreds of millions of dollars every year to people who need it, really it's a little bit backwards.
The U.S. food aid system, as it started and as it is now, it's 100% American-grown food shipped on American-flagged ships. There is no flexibility or very little flexibility for using cash to buy food that may be available in the hunger-stricken countries themselves or in the region. And as we describe in the book, kind of the classic situation where this arose and basically got people really to think about this was the famine of Ethiopia of 2003. That famine was preceded by 2 years of some of the best crops that Ethiopian farmers had ever had. After those two great years of harvest, prices collapsed 80%. So a lot of the food remained in some warehouses of local traders. So in that situation, here comes all this American food aid streaming into the country, but it was coming on the road from the port in Djibouti right past some of the warehouses that were pretty much full to the roof with Ethiopian grown food that there was no market for. There was no money to buy up the surplus crops that were still available.
I want to make that point again. Ethiopia can feed itself, but the markets don't let that system work.
Exactly. So what happened in the famine of 2003 is that the markets failed before the weather did.
You know, you have a great line in the book. You say, quoting some people in Ethiopia, they say, you know, I don't care if it rains in Ethiopia so long as it rains in Iowa.
Absolutely.
The assumption being, you know, that's where the corn that is going to feed us is being grown.
Right. And it really creates this dependency syndrome that instead of the Ethiopian farmers having the incentive to grow as much as possible, there's this thinking in the back of their minds, well, there's the food aid that's going to come in.
Is there anything on the international scene that's going to break that cycle?
With President Obama, minutes into his administration, in his inaugural address, he addressed the poor nations of the world, and he said, we will work to make your farms flourish and clean water flow. To make your farms flourish, that's what we're talking about in terms of the agriculture development that has been so sorely neglected. There's a grassroots movement that's coming from churches and temples and synagogues, from universities, and from philanthropies like the Gates Foundation. I think this awareness and this pressure coming from the grassroots is beginning to grab the attention of the statesmen and political leaders more. There is leadership on this.
Roger Thurow writes for The Wall Street Journal. He and his colleague Scott Kilman have a new book out about global hunger and international food aid. It's called Enough. Roger, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, what your credit card says about you.
20 years ago, you could get age, income, home ownership. Today, you can get thousands of variables.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was short on inspiration today. The Dow Industrials came to rest just 14 points above where it started, gaining not quite 0.2%, closing at 8,178. The Nasdaq managed a gain of only 1 point, barely a fraction of 1%, finished at 1747. A sell-off in financials left the S&P 500 a single point below water, roughly 0.2%, 879 the number. Fresh worries about a lagging economic recovery pushed shares lower at several big banks. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Bank of America all lost more than 2.5% today. JPMorgan Chase fared better at the close, shaving off just 0.3%. Oil prices, as I mentioned, sank to near $60 a barrel as the government reported U.S. gasoline stockpiles are up. The cost of crude has slipped more than 18% in just over a week. Shares of ExxonMobil slipped nearly 0.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note declined to 3.31%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales and inventories for merchant wholesalers for the month of May. Looking ahead to the possibility of further swine flu outbreak, the White House holds an all-day H1N1 flu preparedness summit. And on Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on the financially stressed commercial real estate market. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It will very soon be all healthcare all the time in Washington, whether there should be a public plan or not, who's going to have to give up how much profit to make an overhaul work, and from the consumer end, the age-old question of how to decide which plan is best for you. From Washington, Tamara Keith reports now on one insurer that's taking a page from brand-name retail.
At St. John's Town Center, a shopping mall in Jacksonville, Florida, you can go to Louis Vuitton for a purse, The Gap for khakis, and for health insurance, there's the Florida Blue Store. Nick Tant works for Blue Cross Blue Shield and is the store's manager.
It really fits the needs of a lot of individuals who are busy, have multiple things to do in one day, and we're just positioned to be able to accomplish that need.
The idea is to take the mind-boggling process of shopping for insurance and make it a little more like buying an iPod. Customers are greeted by a concierge. There are workstations for do-it-yourselfers and private rooms for meeting with salespeople.
We've been compared to Apple. It's lots of colors and imagery, but also the ability to provide a unique setting to get information around health insurance.
Most people now get insurance through their job, but with rising unemployment, more people are buying coverage on their own. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida is looking to open 3 more retail centers in the coming months to reach those individuals. Linda Blumberg, a senior health policy fellow at the Urban Institute, says these stores don't address the real reason why so many people are uninsured. She says it's not because they don't know where to shop.
They do nothing to make coverage more affordable for those who are modest income, and they do not address any of the barriers to coverage that exist for those that have significant health care needs.
Whether an insurance store comes to a mall near you may depend on the results of the healthcare debate on Capitol Hill. It could entirely upend the way insurance is marketed. Or not. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Vice President Joe Biden made yesterday's healthcare news official this morning. He announced a deal with three hospital groups that's supposed to save $155 billion in Medicare and Medicaid spending. The hospitals will take less from the government for providing services to the poor and elderly. Commentator David Frum says that's a fine start, but Medicaid's got bigger problems.
Virtually every American state is projecting a budget deficit for this coming fiscal year, and most expect a deficit in fiscal 2011 as well, perhaps $350 billion altogether over the next 24 months. President Obama's chief of staff has advised, never let a crisis go to waste. Let's use this crisis to fix a glaring problem, the catastrophically perverse financing of Medicaid, for almost all states, their fastest-growing budget expense. The federal government pays at least half the cost of Medicaid, more in states with lower average incomes. In other words, rich states with a lot of poor people, California or New York, will receive less for each Medicaid recipient than a state with a lower average income but fewer poor, Wyoming, say. In good times, this arrangement means that states can buy a dollar's worth of extra health coverage for no more than 50 cents, and often much less. In bad times, it means that most of the savings from cutting Medicaid budgets reverts to the federal government. For the state politicians who have to do the cutting, a dollar's worth of political pain saves less than 50 cents of state money. In good times and in bad, states are prevented from innovating and adapting because the federal dollars come attached to strict conditions. No wonder that Medicaid has become America's fastest-growing major social program, but also one of the most rigid and scandal-prone. The people who make the spending decisions should also bear the responsibility for the cost of those decisions. If the states continue to administer Medicaid, the federal contribution must be capped and redirected away from poor states to poor people. Otherwise, this program designed in the 1960s will drag American states into their worst collapse since the 1930s.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We'd love to hear from you. You can write to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Not all that long ago, credit card companies were looking for reasons to give us credit. As we all now know, it didn't take much to get a shiny new piece of plastic in your wallet. But with credit card defaults rising, those companies have started looking for reasons to take some of that credit away. To help them figure out how to do that, banks are compiling thousands of bits of data, like what you buy, where you buy it, sometimes even the company you keep. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith tells us, your credit card is watching you.
So, two guys walk into a bar, have a few drinks, and split the bill on their credit cards. One guy's unemployed and in serious debt. The other has a job and pays all his bills on time. And the joke is actually on both of them. Those drinks may have just cost them their credit. Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation. He says the first problem the card company sees? Booze. Especially if you don't usually put margaritas on your MasterCard.
And alcohol might be a red flag that you're despondent because you're about ready to get laid off from your job.
And splitting a bill with the unemployed debtor makes the employed guy look bad to his card company. And that's just the beginning. Say Mr. Good Credit rewards himself with a rare trip to the spa.
And get a massage. Red flag.
His card company might think he's trying to relax because he's stressed about money. And what if he decides to go bargain hunting?
Oh my gosh, maybe you're about to lose your job. You're starting to downscale to lower-cost stores.
So, if you start splurging, it looks bad, and if you start scrimping, it looks bad. Welcome to the post-credit crisis world of risk management, where your card company watches everything you do and then tries to figure out how likely you are to pay your bills. Analyzing that information is called data profiling, and it's a $25 billion business. One of the biggest players is Equifax. Tom Madison works in the company's mortgage division. He says business is up 50% over last year.
The general direction that the financial industry is taking is towards a place where the data they use to render their conclusions about creditworthiness is the heart and soul of everything that they do.
Madison says banks want more data and more kinds of data than ever. Peter Harvey is the CEO of IntelliDyn. It uses data profiling to help companies market their products.
20 years ago, you could get age, income, home ownership. Today, you can get thousands of variables. Now, it sounds ominous, but think about the amount of transactions that are online today.
Harvey plugs all those bits of information into intricate models, which examine your past actions, figure out what makes you tick, and then predict what you will do. He could look at our upstanding bill payer and figure out where he wants to spend his next vacation.
It's knowing that their next trip was going to be a river cruise in France. You know, what type of boat, what type of amenities.
Harvey says banks are some of the most sophisticated data profilers around, and they're very secretive about it. Regulators have brought some things to light. The Federal Trade Commission recently filed a suit against CompuCredit, which marketed the Visa Aspire card. Riley Dolan was on the litigation team.
CompuCredit was reviewing how consumers use the credit card, and it would lower the available credit to consumers based on their transactional history.
Things that branded card users as risky? Going to a bar, a marriage counselor, getting tires retreaded, buying something off of an infomercial. That's right, your 2 a.m. Snuggie breakdown could cost you your card, which sounds pretty heavy-handed. I mean, sometimes a Snuggie is just a Snuggie, right? NYU economist Lawrence White.
For some individuals, it will not be an adequate representation of their true creditworthiness. That's unfortunately just the nature of the statistical exercise.
White says banks would rather risk cutting the credit of our upstanding bill payer than having another default on their books. So the next time two guys walk into a bar, they should probably think about walking to an ATM first. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
To see a list of what you might want to think twice about putting on your card and to hear more about data profiling, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says The Borrowers.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, you might have heard the big news out of Google late last night. The search company is coming out with a computer operating system, and there's been a lot of buzz about it being a threat to Microsoft. And that may or may not be true, but if it is, Microsoft is going to have plenty of time to get ready. Google Chrome OS isn't going to hit the market until the second half of 2010. That would be a year or more from right now. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 14 points, almost 0.2%. The NASDAQ added a single point, a tiny fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 fell that same point, a tenth of 1%. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, from cars to windmills in Michigan.
We made parts by hand, one at a time, in Reno, Nevada. It cost us $9,000. We now make that same machine for $2,500 in Manistee, Michigan.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.